3, our daily Monday through Friday update for you with Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD, where we bring you the latest and best information on the coronavirus pandemic. Whether they want to call it that or not doesn't matter to me. Here's the breaking story of the day. The coronavirus has hit a California-based cruise ship, prompting quarantine off the Pacific coast. Sound familiar? Not Yokohama Harbor and the Corona Princess. This is another Princess cruise ship, and this one is off San Francisco. It's called the Grand Princess. Well, maybe we could call it the Grand Corona Princess. At any rate, it's got 2,500 plus passengers. They don't mention crew here. You could figure there's 1,500 crew anyway. There may be 4,000 people on this boat. It traveled to Mexico, and a man who was on board died more than 10 days after returning home without prior knowledge of his exposure. Two shiploads of passengers may, get this one, two shiploads of passengers may have been exposed. State and federal officials are scurrying to contact 2,500 plus passengers who disembarked February 21st from the San Francisco-Mexico cruise at the same time as the man who died. California is also keeping the Grand Princess passengers on the current San Francisco trip in the Pacific Ocean indefinitely until state and federal officials can assess how many passengers and crew have coronavirus or who have been exposed. We have a number of passengers and crew members who have developed symptoms on the ship, said California's loony Governor Newsom. I said that this afternoon. They're airlifting test kits to the Grand Princess. So they're going to apparently test. But Henry, as we saw with the Corona Princess off the Yokohama Harbor and then in the harbor, the people quarantined to the ship were in many ways quarantined and absolutely consigned to come down with the virus. They had no choice, no chance, and it was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. So they're going to do it again, maybe. Same old thing. And they got a second shipload that departed the ship with the sick guy who died. So good luck. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back. It's kind of a rerun here, I guess, with this one. And I got a little bit more detail on it. Gavin Newsom actually just got off the press conference, so it's tonight. It might have been afternoon. It wasn't even afternoon. He literally just got off within the last 30 minutes
or
so.
He did an update then. All right. What do you got?
And, it's quite remarkable. The first cruise, went from San Francisco to Mexico, I think, in Sonata, and back. And it came back on the 21st. And they had two passengers that got off the ship and developed symptoms and have been COVID confirmed. One of those two passengers died yesterday. He was in Placer County. And then the other one, I think, was in Solano County, but there was another northern county. So there were two positives. And of course, they were interested in where all the other passengers were. And there were 2,500 passengers, 50% of whom were Californians. And the CDC and the state of California started an investigation. They have the ship's manifest, and they were trying to track down these 2,500 passengers to see if any of them were symptomatic or had actually been diagnosed already. And when they started to go through the list, they found that 62 of the passengers had signed up for the next cruise, and they were actually on the same ship. going to Hawaii. And they went to Hawaii, and then they were heading back to Mexico. They were scheduled to go to Ensenada, Mexico, and they were intercepted. And they said that these 62 passengers had to be separated from the rest of the passengers, and that the ship had to return to port in San Francisco. It wasn't going to go to Mexico again. And
how long, Henry? How long approximately?
And that's where it is.
How long were the 62 on board with the entire new complement of passengers circulating amongst them? Do we know?
Well, it never left San Francisco, so they didn't leave San Francisco. So I imagine there was like a day or two layover. You know, okay. The other one ended on the 21st, and this one probably began, you know, a day or two after that. Uh-huh. And then they sailed to Hawaii. They went to Hawaii, and they, you know, probably walked around Hawaii and then got back on the ship to go down to Ensenada. And that's when the CDC realized that there were 62 passengers on that ship. I mean, they were trying to find these 2,500, and 62 of them were still on the ship. And so they radioed the ship and said, you're not going to Ensenada, you're going to San Francisco, but you're not, you know, unloading your passengers. You're going to sit here, we're going to fly kits onto the ship, and we're going to test those 62 passengers. And we're also going to test the other 20 passengers who were symptomatic. So they, you know, it seems very likely that this is a rerun. And, you know, they have 20 that are symptomatic. You know, some might have the flu, who knows. But the fact that 62 of those passengers had already been exposed to the two that were confirmed, as well as who knows how many others were on the ship that have not, you know, none of them, I imagine, have been tested. And half of them are somewhere in California, probably mostly Northern California. And the
you
other...
You had to say that, didn't you? I'm about 8 miles over the border. Thanks. All right.
Yeah. Well, there were 2,500 on the first ship, and that might have just been the passengers. Mm-hmm. And on this one, they said there's 3,000 on board, which I assume includes the crew, because they said it was the passengers and crew that were symptomatic. And an article just came out in the San Francisco Herald or whatever it is, that gave those numbers. They said that 20 were symptomatic. So, you know, it is kind of a rerun. They had 120 symptomatic on the Emerald Princess, or Diamond Princess. And, I mean, this is the same company as the Grand Princess.
Yeah, I know.
And somebody said, I can't believe that anybody would get on a cruise ship again. And I said, what are you talking about? They got 62. They got on two of them already. He went down to Mexico. They came back, and they went out to Hawaii on a second trip on the same ship.
Yeah.
And so that's a... news you can use right off the press, and there's no telling what they're going to end up with or what they're going to do with them. I mean, they've got 62 that are you know, somewhat segregated, and then I assume they've got the 20 symptomatic somewhat segregated, and the CDC is involved, and they're flying, you know, the kits, the 200 kits, I think, and they're going to start testing them, and, you know, if they start getting positives, which I think is probably when they start getting positives, then they'll decide how many more they're going to test. And if they don't test everybody there, you know, it'll be a lessons not learned. And it's hard to believe they couldn't get a lesson out of the other. I mean, there's still Americans in Japan from the other one, and there's and they also make up almost half of the cases in San Francisco or in California. They gave an update. There's 53 in California that are COVID confirmed, and 24 of them are repatriated from most of them are from the Diamond Princess, I think, in California. They had two from Wuhan, and so that's the breaking news. There's another piece of information that just happened, and that is one of the sequences from the people associated with the long-term care facility in King County, Washington, released tonight. And that sequence does match the other two sequences from Snohomish County. So they've got three sequences from people in Washington. They had one other one that was imported from South Korea. That one was different. But the three that they have so far from Washington all match each other. And that includes the first one that was first identified in mid-January. And then the first community case in Snohomish County, which was Snohomish County, which was the 17-year-old high school. Snohomish, which is a 17-year-old high school student. And and so those were both in Snohomish County, so they were relatively close to each other. And the question was whether the same lineage and the same strain, because it wasn't just a lineage, there was one rare mutation that was on both of the earlier two that is now in this third one. So all three of them that are local match each other, and it indicates that when the first patient came from Wuhan and went to see the doctor, that he had he ended up transmitting that to somebody in Washington, and then it continued to circulate that whole time. And they didn't come up with any positives. They looked at some of his contacts, and they were all negative. And so he was the only one that was identified. And actually, the second one, as far as the sequence was concerned, was the high school student. So what that says is the virus was there all of that time. And then that story is actually related. I haven't posted it yet, but there's a paper that was published, a preprint of it, I think, in China regarding a mutation that's already happened, is how the paper put it. And they indicated that there was a mutation that was associated with increased virulence. And I looked at the paper, and it's kind of it's kind of interesting how they came up with their rationale. But essentially, what they're saying is they were comparing the sequences to the bat sequences, and found that this one lineage, which is the ORF8 lineage, so that's the one I've been talking about, and that
that's
is the one
you were
in the
first
Seattle
to bring
area.
That up. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But what they're saying is that it actually is the other way around. And they're saying that sequence was the original sequence. And the reason they're saying that is because some of the changes that distinguish that lineage can be found in the bats. And I think if you recall, I mentioned that earlier, that one mm-hmm. of the reasons you knew it wasn't weaponized is that it basically matches the bat sequence for some of the polymorphisms, and that it's heterogeneous. So you have a couple different versions of it, and anything that was created in the, you know, used in the lab to either make a vaccine or to make a bioweapon, which I've said countless times makes zero sense because you don't have any control over it. And you saw what happened. You've got a pandemic right now. So the idea that you would use a coronavirus as a bioweapon.
The changes in the cleavage issue, is that something that just occurs naturally? That's not unusual, or is that a kind of a very rare thing? Or is it normal?
It's in all the high paths. All the high paths.
They're all just looking for, that's the nature of the beast.
They all have a polybasic cleavage site. And Newcastle disease, the high path version of Newcastle mm-hmm, disease, mm-hmm. has a polybasic cleavage site. It's the life cycle of the virus. The virus basically binds to a receptor. It's got to mm-hmm. cleave its envelope protein. It's made as a long protein, and then it gets cleaved into two pieces. And mm-hmm. to do that cleavage, it requires an enzyme in the cell. It doesn't have the gene for the enzyme to do the protease that cleaves it. And the protease is common. That's why, you know, you've heard of protease inhibitors for HIV.
Sure.
HIV has to do the same thing. They've got to do the same cleavage. RNA uh-huh. tumor viruses have to do the same thing. Influenza has to do the same thing. Coronaviruses have to do the same thing. They all kind of have this same life cycle. They've got a little bit of genetic information. They make a couple of structural proteins to kind of package everything up. They encode polymerases to copy their genetic information, and that's it. Everything else is done is just hijacking all the machineries of the cells they infect. And one of the pieces of machinery is a protease that cleans their protein. So their protein, they don't make that enzyme. They rely upon the cell. And the cleavage is normally just one basic amino acid. This is normally an arginine, and it cleaves right next to the arginine. And it's limited with the one basic amino acid, and it's very specific as to what protease does that. And that limits it. In flu, it limits it to the upper respiratory tract. So that, and coronavirus is the same thing. So normally it would be limited as to what cells it can get into, because uh-huh. the enzyme they need is not that widespread. When they get a polybasic cleavage site, then they've got a whole series of basic amino acids in a row. In the case of the coronavirus, it picked up two additional arginines. So instead of having one, it's got three. And those extra two represent a cleavage site for the protease called furin, F-U-R-I-N. So then any cell type that makes that protease, that makes furin, and has the right receptor, which is an ACE2 receptor. So there's an ACE2 receptor, and they make furin protease, then the virus can get into that cell. And furin is much more widespread, and so they can get into a lot of different cell types. And therefore, they can grow in different cell types, so the virus it's got more cells that it can hijack and use to make more variants. So the fact that it has a polybasic cleavage site, just like all of these other viruses that have polybasic cleavage sites, tells you that this is not something manufactured, that it happens all the time, and it gives an advantage for the virus. The virus can therefore replicate in several different cell types, make more virus, and then more effectively infect the next person because there's more virus made because it can use more cells. And so it's not unusual at all. I mean, all the high path, I mean, it's so efficient that they used to do a biological assay for influenza to find out, you know, whether it's high path or low path. And, you know, they basically take the virus and they put it into chickens and they monitor the chickens for 10 days and see if they get sick or if they die. And they scored, and that determines, you know, depending upon how many are affected, whether it's high or low path. And then they found out that it correlates like 100% with a polybasic cleavocyte. If it's got a polybasic cleavocyte and it's H5 or H7 in influenza, it's going to be high path. So if they do that biological experiment, they'll see that they generally die, and they generally die within a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And depending upon how long it takes to die, they end up getting a score, and they have a cutoff. If it's a score above such and such, it'll be high path. And they're always high path. So they don't even do that test anymore. They just look at the sequence and see if there's a polybasic cleavocyte. And H5N1 did that, and the H5 and H5N1 ended up, you know, going into other serotypes, reassorting. So there's H5N8, H5N6. All of those are high path H5. And because it's so devastating, that's why they're both reportable diseases. Any H5 or H7 is reportable, even if it's low path, because they know that on the farm, they can start as low path, and then they usually end up recombining, and they don't even use homologous recombination. They use non-homologous. So they actually find a polybasic stretch on another protein, in another gene, and they recombine and grab that and stick that in to the cleavage site and go from low path to high path. So you can see it go from low path to high path on a given farm. There's nobody running in there and grabbing the chickens and getting the virus and sticking a polybasic cleavocyte into it and then turning it loose on the farm. They start out as low and they go to high on the farm in a matter of a couple of weeks. It isn't man-made. You don't need a P4 facility. You don't need somebody planning to destroy the world by making this bioweapon that they have no control over and let it go and see what happens. I mean, the people that dream these up have know nothing about the science. They know nothing about, they're kind of like the president. They don't know the difference between a coronavirus and a flu virus. I mean, he wants to use a flu vaccine on the coronavirus because you know, he's looking for a good one. If they got a good one, we should give it a try. Yeah. And that way they don't have to wait a year. They can do it right now. He's telling people to go to work. Don't worry about it. It's like a cold virus.
He said it was a hoax, too, remember? Come on, it's all nuts. Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
I just want to get back to more of the mainstream stuff here. But wrap up. It's good. It's very valuable information.
Well, I mean, that's one of the problems. One of the problems are there's all these bioweapon kind of, it's just nonsense. The people that do these conspiracies have no scientific background. They really have no idea what they're talking about. They're all based on time and space type stuff. Well, you know, it happened in Wuhan. There's a P4 lab there. There's a lab that actually does work on coronaviruses. And therefore, it must have been a bioweapon. They totally missed the fact that the first criteria of a bioweapon is that you have to be able to control it. Because if you can't control it and you take something like a coronavirus,
it's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
You already saw what happened with SARS. So it's already kind of shown what it can do. And then you're going to make some change. This one's related to SARS, but it's not that close. You really don't know at all how this virus is going to behave in the human population. So the idea that you would make some modification and then turn it loose on a human population and then think it's going to do whatever you want it to do, is ludicrous. It isn't going to. It mutates.
Well,
it changes.
Okay.
You don't know how it's going to behave.
And
the same thing comes up with every one of these. It comes up with H5N1. It came up with H1N1. It came up with H7N9. It came up with SARS. And now it's coming up with this SARS 2.
Well,
if it's a novel virus, as long as it's a novel virus, they think it's something that hasn't been seen in humans before, then the only way it could have got there is somebody modified it and it either escaped or they deliberately did
the
it.
The HIV that they found in it really kicked off and triggered much of conspiracy aspects.
Do you know how they found the HIV?
You told us briefly once.
I'll simplify it again. Okay.
Tell us again.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of like everybody knows how to do a Google search. Okay. I'll give you an example. So let's say you wanted to find out what the lyrics are to the cow jumped over the moon. Okay. Now, if you go to Google if you type in the cow jumped, it'll actually autofill in over the moon. You hit enter and you get a whole bunch of things about the nursery rhyme, the cow jumped over the moon. Okay. If instead of doing that, you just stick in the word moon and you've been doing a whole lot of conspiracy stuff, what you're probably going to get at the top of the list is that the moon landing was fake. And then you're going to get to, 9/11 was fake. And then you're going to get to Sandy Hook was fake. And then you're going to decide, there isn't even that nursery rhyme. This whole thing is a conspiracy. And there's just a whole bunch of conspiracies out there. That's what you're going to get if you search moon, if you make it a very narrow search. Mm-hmm. And that's what these guys did. They took the sequence. They went and they saw that there were some gaps in the sequence that didn't line up with the bat sequence. So they went and they took those very short regions and they went to GeneBank and they did a search. And as soon as I saw that they had gotten HIV, I did this 17 years ago. I wasn't even looking for gaps. I was looking for individual polymorphisms. And there really wasn't much in the database at the time because nobody had sequenced SARS yet. SARS was brand new. And so if I went and I made the search very narrow, very short, if I took the stretch and made it smaller and smaller, I would start to get matches. You know what I'd get matches with? I'd get matches with HIV. And you know why I would get matches with HIV?
No.
Because there are a lot of HIV sequences at GeneBank. So you go and you take something really small you get it to match something that there's a lot of in your target. Your target's GeneBank, and you end up finding HIV sequences. And that's exactly what they did. And when I saw the abstract, I didn't even read the paper. I just went right to the figure. And I said, how big are these gaps that they're looking for? And they were 3 or 4 amino acids. So they were only like
that was it.
9 to 12 nucleotides long. They were very short.
Right.
And therefore, they're going to go and pick up what's most abundant. So there are no HIV sequences in the sequence. There are matches when you take a very tiny piece of it. But that's because there's a lot of HIV sequences in GeneBank. And there were a lot of HIV sequences in GeneBank 17 years ago when I did the same type of a search. So it's utter nonsense. And that paper was retracted within 2 days. So it came out. It wasn't peer-reviewed. People read it, and they came up with all these reasons why they knew it was an artifact. They know that these gaps happen all the time. They knew that if you make a short search like that, you're going to get cross reactivities with things that happen to cross react because you're taking too small of an area. And so it's just like if you did your Google search on moon, you aren't necessarily going to get the nursery rhyme, the cow jumped over the moon. You very well can get something about the moonwalker. It's made of green cheese. and come to that conclusion because your search was very, well, too narrow. So there are no HIV sequences in these sequences, in the SARS-CoV. There's cross-reactivity there, and the scientists know that when they make these probes, when you make these primers, et cetera, you have to make them big enough so that they end up targeting what you want and not targeting something else that has a similar sequence for a very short stretch and give you false positives. So that's just the nature of the beast. There's only four letters. It's only ATGC. And if you take a short segment, you can get them lined up and get them in one protein and get them in another protein. And in fact, there may be something to it way, way back when, you know, when they were evolving, there might have been a common protein that kind of went off in different directions and a little piece of it's still there. So, but that has nothing to do with it today. The fact that you've got a little sequence that is an HIV and there could have been some progenitor sequence way back when different viruses evolved and the HIV took this little piece and coronavirus took this little piece and influenza virus took this little piece. And if you make it small enough, you can find that sequence in all of them. But that doesn't mean somebody put them there. And that doesn't mean that they're unusual. That just means you did a search that you didn't make it broad and long enough to have any specificity. So you end up with just cross reactivity. But people see that, HIV. HIV shouldn't be in a coronavirus. And even the logic of it, biologically, how are you going to get that combination? It's not like you've got a ton of HIV floating around and you got a lot of coronavirus floating around and then you're going to go and have all these different recombinations that went on this section and that section and that section. And it's just, it was ludicrous from the beginning. And that's why if you go to that paper, got a big red mark, a big red banner across it and it says, this manuscript has been withdrawn.
Withdrawn.
Scientists don't write up papers and put the time into it. So that 2 days later, there's a big stamp on it, withdrawn, indicating that there was something really wrong with this paper. And they went ahead and didn't realize it and submitted it, assuming that it would eventually get published. And it would not have gotten published. It would have been, as soon as it went into peer review, they would have looked at that and they would have
dinged it.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay.
They would have dinged it in 10 seconds. But that's still around. I mean, that's still about there.
Oh, it's not. It's not ever going to go away.
Right, it'll
be around. It's part of the territory now. All right, what I want to do, let's kind of get caught up here. In Oregon, the health authorities here are now admitting that 300 to 500 cases of coronavirus are, in all likelihood, running loose in the state. Well, it could be 3,000. They don't know. But the point is they're beginning to talk about it now as an out-of-control issue. And that's the news from Oregon. L.A. County is now a disaster zone in terms of their proclamation of everything being in an emergency footing now. When this breaks loose among the homeless, though, you're going to see a lot of very unpleasant news stories. Wait and see.
Well, the other place that's going to break loose is in New York. And was kind of the breaking news this morning. I mean, it was the breaking news yesterday morning, but it was breaking news again this morning. Now, yesterday it was breaking news because they had potential community spread there. The index case had not traveled to any of the, five countries that are to be avoided type thing. Although initially they said he went to Miami, but he also went to Israel. So it's conceivable this wasn't really a community case. But in any event, it's definitely a problem because what happened is he got infected. And then he infected his entire family. So his wife was infected, his daughter was, his son was, and the guy that drove him to the hospital was, his neighbor was. So they had five positives right off the bat. And and he's a lawyer. He works in New Rochelle. He lives in New Rochelle. He works in Manhattan. Uh-huh. And so there were schools in both New Rochelle area as well as down in the Bronx. They were closed because that's where his kids went to school. And initially they were closed just because he was positive. But then the news yesterday was that his whole family was positive. And then Cuomo held a press conference and said that, you know, they were going to step things up. He had a $40 million program. They were going to get the labs in the state, mm-hmm. either state labs or university labs, or university labs set up so they could run these tests. And they would make sure they had the machinery. Most of them already had, you know, they can do a PCR test, so they already had that. But they would train them on right. how to use the primers and actually run the tests, and they'd do 1,000 tests.
Your point about New York, let me just back up a little bit. Think about cruise ships. Think about all those high-rise buildings and how people live within them. And it's a similar kind of a thing. These buildings with so many people packed so densely. Remember, it's the Metropole Hotel all over again. And
yeah.
All you need is one or two cases.
What they're worried about is they're worried about the schools and you know, taking the train in from New Rochelle down to Manhattan.
Right.
You're riding
Subways,
on a train
watch
with
what happens.
Crap full of people.
Yeah.
And this has already happened. I mean, he's already been infected. He's actually in critical condition. He's in a coma, I think. So he's seriously ill. The rest of his family are not as serious. But a couple of them have symptoms. A couple of them are just positive. And they don't have symptoms yet. You know, this may be a time thing. But after that big announcement yesterday, this morning starts off with the same thing all over again, because a close friend of his was mm-hmm. positive, and right. he infected his whole family. So right. his wife was positive, and his two boys were positive, and his daughter was positive. And they've got all of their schools. So they have all of these schools that are shut down for cleaning and for testing. And then they have, they're both Orthodox Jews, so they've got their synagogues closed down, uh-huh. and they've got all the members of the synagogue in quarantine now. There's over 1,000 people that are in quarantine now. And this is the same general group that had the big measles outbreak because they hadn't been vaccinated, and
right.
they ended up, you know, most of the cases in that whole measles outbreak were actually in the same community. And so the concern is that it's going to run through this community because a lot of them have quite a few children. They kind of congregate together.
Sure.
They go to the same synagogues. They have the same daycare centers. They've got the same schools. You know, they're usually private schools. And so the potential there is just going to run through those. And Cuomo's already said there, you know, he expects to have a lot more cases. And they're going to go to the schools and basically, you know, test everybody symptomatic.
Oh, yeah. Let me jump over here. Here's something new. Recovered patient dies as a 36-year-old man has died in Wuhan from respiratory failure. Days, you saw this, days after being discharged from a hospital, apparently as being adjudged to have been well. One. We have reports also.
And that's not the only example of that happening. That
I'm
has
sure.
happened several times now.
All right. Another cruise ship, this one called the Aida Aura, A-U-R-A, Aida Aura, a German cruise ship being held in Norway now due to fears coronavirus on board. 32 reported cases in Norway. Anyway, the ship is, there's thought to be several cases, two German passengers at least suspected of being infected with the coronavirus. So there's another cruise ship. Here's another one. It is now being reported that some unethical healthcare workers are hoarding masks and other medical supplies for themselves and their families and to sell and make a little extra cash. So it's not a surprise, none of this. It's what you'd expect, unfortunately. So just a few updates for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are indications of what is to come, really. Because essentially now that the virus is widespread and unfortunately it's not entirely clear how widespread it is. I mean, I said this yesterday, they're making policy decisions, who's going to come where and where you should go and where you shouldn't go. And they don't know what it's like where you are. They don't know whether Seattle is safer than Wuhan, or if Wuhan is actually a safer place to be because they, shut the city down and cut their numbers way down. And I actually saw a report that China was screening passengers flying into China.
Correct.
And they got something like 75 positives.
Imported cases. That's right. That's right.
Trying to get into China were screened and identified as already being infected coming in. And since it's spreading like it is, the argument, I don't know how valid this paper was from China that was talking about the mutation and having the more aggressive and the less aggressive version. But a lot of the virus that came to the U.S. first falls into what they're calling the less aggressive genotype. And that happened in Washington, and it happened in Chicago, and it happened in L.A., and it happened in Phoenix. All of those were the same one with the ones I characterized as having this ORF8 mutation. So according to them, they think this is the less aggressive virus. Uh-huh. And that the more aggressive virus didn't have these changes, and those were the ones that were in Wuhan. So Wuhan didn't have the changes.
Does that make a lot of sense to you?
Well, they seem to have a more aggressive virus there initially. And
correct.
I mean, the one that came to the U.S., you could see that they were the same lineage. It really wasn't clear how aggressive they were going to be. And they, before they got into the long-term care facility, there weren't any deaths in the U.S. And most of those patients weren't that serious. Some of them, weren't even. Several of them didn't get pneumonia, and the only reason they were quarantined is because they tested. It wasn't that they were that sick. Some were asymptomatic and some were just mildly symptomatic.
Yeah, important question here. Is the pneumonia often, sometimes, bacterial and viral, or just one or the other? What are we hearing? What are you hearing?
Well, pneumonia could be either, but the pneumonia that they're talking about is due to the virus.
It's viral.
So these are viral pneumonia because they've got this coronavirus. And that's why they named it what they named. I mean, SARS, the S is for severe. And when they did case fatality reports numbers, they were just looking at pneumonia cases. I mean, that's all they were really screening. At the beginning, they didn't even have a test, so they had to do it, with a clinical presentation. And the first thing they had to do is they had to have had an x-ray or a CT scan, they showed they had pneumonia. The pneumonia was what defined the disease. And the same mm-hmm. thing for MERS. Mm-hmm. Those were both dependent upon pneumonia. And the COVID started out requiring pneumonia. That's what the definition was. And that's how, and before they had the PCR test, that's how they determined who the positive cases were. They all had pneumonia. And that's what was the alarm bell was. They had all these patients showing up in the emergency room with a department with an atypical pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the case fatality rate was really based on. It was pneumonia cases that go in the hospital, and then they looked at the outcome. If they got discharged, you know, that's what went in the denominator, along with all the ones that died, and the ones that died go in the numerator. So they were just calculating that on pneumonia cases. And the ones in Wuhan, you know, they had a lot of pneumonia cases. And so it was fairly severe. The ones here, they ended up changing the definition. And I think they changed the definition because they're going to have a case fatality rate, you know, in the double digits, and that was going to be too alarming. And so if they went, they included all these mild cases that didn't get pneumonia, and those cases all survived. They went and they had a much bigger number in the denominator, so they got the case fatality rate down to 2-3%, and they said it was still high, but it sounded better. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the cases that were in Wuhan seemed to be pretty serious as far as going on to death, and it's not even clear that, you know, all the fatalities were being reported. But if you look now, the version that was in Italy and the version that's in Iran, they don't have this ORF 8 change. They really look more like the Wuhan sequence. I mean, they have some changes and they can be divided up, but they don't have the changes that that had the ORF 8. And so they are arguing that that's a more aggressive virus, and that's part of what's fueling all the activity in Europe and the Middle East, just because the Italian sequence as well as the Iranian sequence do not have this ORF8 change that I've described. So they would say it's more aggressive. And some of the ones in the United States are in that category. I mean, they're actually becoming more common. And the point was that when you have an even more aggressive virus and you're getting better transmission. If you notice, it seems that there's more labs doing testing now, and they are doing more testing. And a lot of these labs are using their own kits that they basically
making themselves. That's right.
In-house.
That's right.
Yeah. But they seem to be getting a lot more clusters, so that when they get a positive, they end up getting a positive for the whole family. So like these two that are in New York, they both ended up with 5 positives each day, because they not only had the index cases being positive, but they were able to detect the virus in all of the close contacts. You know, so all, it wasn't just a family member, you know, not just the spouse was infected, but all of the kids were infected, and it happened in both of these families. And so when you have that higher transmission rate, then you're going to have these instances where it doesn't matter where the cruise ship is. It doesn't have to be in Asia and you know, make a stop in Hong Kong and worrying about how many cases there are in Hong Kong that came from China, that now you can be a cruise ship up in, off the coast of Europe and have somebody from Germany or have somebody from Sweden or England that brings the virus onto the ship, and then it starts to spread on the ship because it transmits more easily. And it's the same thing here. You end up, there's enough virus floating around Northern California that if you have a cruise ship that starts in Northern California, there's a reasonable chance that of those, 3,000 people or 2,500 passengers that get on the ship, that you're going to have a few of them that are positive. And then if it's one of these, 14-day cruises, that's plenty of time for even the ones that are infected and are asymptomatic when they originally get on, for them to develop symptoms and for them to start transmitting the virus. And so the fact that there's multiple cruise ships that not only are suspect, but they've got multiple people with symptoms, there's probably a pretty good chance that they are going to be positive.
Pretty good chance.
Especially if you get towards the end of the flu season. I mean, the flu season is still going fairly strong, but it's got to start fading. And then if they got flu-like symptoms in a couple of weeks, then it's going to be a much higher likelihood that it really is from the SARS-CoV.
Right. Okay. All right. Got it. Very good.
Okay.
Lots of things happening. So, we'll see. We'll know more tomorrow about the new cruise ship epic unfolding off the coast of San Francisco.
One I do not see turning out very good. That seems like it's destined to be another disaster here.
I'm afraid so. All right. Thank you, Henry. As always, talk to you tomorrow night.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Dr. Henry Nyman and the cruise ship, we'll watch it for you very carefully, and watching most everything else for you very carefully as well. Back with you tomorrow in 21 hours. See you then.